Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
Today on the Indie Opera Podcast, sometimes the people behind the news are just as interesting as the news itself. Today we have Andrew Rudin, a composer who is petitioning the Met to dedicate its opening night gala to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. Because this is a news story, I wanted to make sure I did some fact-checking, and in the middle of the show, you'll hear a small correction. Also, we do mention a term that we don't define in the podcast, 12-tone serialism. I've included a link to an article on it if you don't know what it is, but basically, it's a system of composing that makes all notes in the scale equal by assigning each note a number and creating an order for the numbers called a row. For more information, check out the article. We had some recording issues through Skype, so some of the sound quality is a little sketchy, so please bear with us. The discussion is really interesting, and I didn't want to edit anything out. Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter.
This is Noah.
This is Walker.
And this is Andrew.
Awesome. You jumped right in and learned it right away.
Well, why not?
All right.
I'm a good study.
You're our first guest to ever do that on the first try. So we have Andrew Rudin, with us, amazing composer who not only has worked with some of the great teachers that we were talking about before he came on the air. We're talking about some of the teachers he worked with. Let me say that again. Not only he's worked with some.
No, Peter, you got to stop. You got to stop. This is the new aesthetic. We can make mistakes. We can stumble about.
Uh-huh. Okay.
See wrong things.
And we can speak slowly and carefully.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
I don't know if I'll keep that in, but
just
I'll
to think
keep
we're going. Okay. That's not with the you. That we're all just kind of around a dining room together. And it's not, you know, this scary, vacuous hyperspace. That it's just, we're all just hanging out.
Yes, the steak is delicious. Go on. Yes.
I should try to be brave.
The hyper steak.
Exactly. Yes,
absolutely.
So Andrew Rudin actually has written some of the music for Satyricon, as well as worked with some of the greatest composers of the entire 20th century, and I'm sure we're going to get into that. Also, has been putting around a petition for the Metropolitan Opera to dedicate their opening gala to support LGBT people. Actually, I have it backwards on here, LGTB, but that's all right.
I know, I keep getting them twisted around and people keep correcting me, but...
When it's changing too, because it's like there's, queers being added and... You know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if it's of much value to get it right because it'll change. It'll be different.
You never know where to put those transgender people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right now they're in the middle. So, LGTB. Sorry about that. That's embarrassing.
No, it's good.
So actually, let's start by talking about this petition.
Well, I want to. Can I start? Because I had a thought. I had a cogent thought about this. Which is that, I just tend to be someone who I don't like protests in general.
I don't either. I've never been involved in one before.
Me neither. I've been fascinated by them. I've gone to see them. I think they're interesting as things, as kind of sociological phenomenon or whatever. But I just don't join them, and I'm always reluctant to join causes in general. But this seems like a really cool thing to do in reaction to a policy that
See, I don't see this as a protest. I don't actually think that it requires any kind of visual symbol. I'm completely 100% against anything that would disrupt the performance or show disrespect to the performers. Mm-hmm. People have written me and said, "Oh, we should all stand and turn our backs to Trebko and all that kind of stuff."
No, other
people have said, "Oh, we want to organize groups demonstrating outside." And I said, "Well, I'm a 74-year-old man. I'm sure not going to be organizing that."
But wait a second. Let's mention why this is happening, because if some listeners might not know.
Well, yeah.
This has to do with poutine. Sorry, I just...
Poutine? Like the snack food from Canada?
Yeah. Which is what, you know, I would go to that protest. No, it's Putin's recent laws against homosexual people in Russia. And why particularly would you want the Metropolitan Opera to have a response to that?
Well, because Anna Netrebko and Valery Gergiev have made themselves highly visible figures in support of Putin's policies before he declared these homosexual crackdowns. They cozied up to him, I think partly to feather their nest with artistic causes like the new Mariinsky Theater and so forth. And of course, all of this was set up at the Met years ago. You know how the contracts are done so far in advance and everything. I don't think anybody saw this coming down the pike. Very likely not Netrebko or Gergiev either. So now here they are sort of with their tail in a crack because they, of course, as people working on the international opera stage, they perform all over the world. And excuse me, but who the heck is doing her hair and makeup and design her costumes and so forth and so on? You know they're working with gay people all the time, and not only that, but then of course the great irony that here they are earning a handsome salary in our opera house performing a work by music's most well-known homosexual composer. And I just as a gay man who never thought I'd live to see the day where our own country would make such progress, I just can't abide the idea that they're dancing on Tchaikovsky's grave this way. It just totally goes against everything in my being. So all I want is for the Met to do something positive.
So let's just say what they're doing. They're doing Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin, right?
Yeah, one of my very favorite operas in all the repertory, and I have absolutely no doubt that they will deliver splendidly. I think Netrebko shows every indication of being the ideal Tatiana, but there's going to be a very big elephant in the room, as I said to the Met when they responded to me. I said, "Well, thank you for your response, but no matter what happens, there's going to be a lot of people saying, 'What? You have racists performing Showboat? I don't get it.'" You know?
No, wait a second. Now let's be fair. This is relatively new. This is something that Putin has done within the past couple months.
Entirely true.
And their cozying up to him was prior to him, you know, making these public announcements.
That's true.
Have they said anything, or has there been any response from them to say, you know, we could condemn Putin's position now? Because they might have not have known Putin's position.
Oh, I'm sure they know it now, but I doubt very seriously that they ever imagined when they signed on with him that anything like this would be coming down the pike. Now they find themselves in the uncomfortable position of if they support the equality for gay people, they are essentially breaking the law in Russia and are subject to imprisonment and fine. That's why Lady Gaga tweeted after she was there and saying, "Why didn't you arrest me while you had the chance?"
Hasn't it been confirmed at any point that they actually are homophobic or that they have any feelings at all about gay people?
I will have to say that I erred in my wording of my petition in drawing the assumption that by their tacit posture that they support. It was wrong of me to say that. I should have worded it more carefully. Now I can't go back and
it alter seems-
the wording. But Netrebko did issue a statement, and it was very much along the same lines as what the Met says, trying to say, well, of course, I believe in fair treatment for all people, but I believe in artistic values and so forth and so on. And it was all basically that sort of like, oh, we're above all of this kind of thing. So she made an attempt to put a good face on it, but she didn't say one way or the other, really. Just as the Met says, oh, we support everybody, but, you know, we're not getting involved in this. Well, excuse me, but I keep wondering what Rostropovich and Vizhnevskaya would be doing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of
amongst others.
Well, it's position, though. Wasn't Stravinsky in that position? Wasn't Shostakovich in that position with
absolutely. But Stravinsky took a posture aside from that after he realized the error of his ways. Likewise, even Toscanini was a supporter of Mussolini initially, and then became a rabid anti-fascist and refused to conduct in Italy until that was over.
I feel like we'll spin out if we start drawing lines between artists who are connected to fascist movements or political, you know, networks that we find deplorable. Like that's you could just, you know, throw a rock in the 20th century and you hit a hero who is at ties to a monster. But
Richard
in this particular Richard Strauss, oh my God. But with this particular instance, I think that if they had said nothing about Putin's policies to begin with, then they would have nothing to account for, honestly.
Exactly.
But they endorsed this man, and and that's when you endorse someone, or you endorse the president of a country, you endorse the decisions they make, and you kind of need to amend what you've said. If what you've said is, oh, this guy is fantastic, we love Putin, and then he comes out with this really, I would say, really strange legislature, especially to the West.
Very, very strange. Yes.
Very strange, archaic, and gross. You know.
How can they be among the company of civilized nations? And most of all, how can they dishonor their own great artistic legacy this way? You know. That appalls me. You know, Tchaikovsky would be worse off going back to Russia today if he were alive than in his own time when he had a bad enough time of it already. You know, I just find that amazing, you know.
Yeah. Well, he could drink the water now, though, possibly.
that might make him still with us, at least. Right.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a petition going around. I signed it early on, not really knowing too much about it. It just sounded like a good thing to do. And how many signatures do you have now?
I have, last time I checked, was 1,767.
Wow.
Yeah.
So now that...
As petitions go, that's pretty puny still.
Right.
But I'm sure there's so many more people out there who would strongly agree. You know, I mean, how are you doing the signing? Is it actually, you know, person by person signing it, or is it an online thing?
Well, they're online, and they put their name and they put where they're from, and those who wish leave a comment. And I've been amazed to see how many there are from the Russian Federation who have dared to leave messages, and they come from all over the place, from Bulgaria and Tajikistan and Texas and God knows, you know. And the messages are quite moving oftentimes, and I've been really, really struck by the vastness of it goes all over the globe, you know, and it's amazing how quickly this kind of things happen on the internet. But you'd be interested to know that a reporter from the New York Times spent about an hour with me on the phone this afternoon. I don't know where they're going with this, but he was basically researching material about this for an article, and we'll see what happens with that. Trying to get Rachel Maddow's attention, because surely it's something that she would perhaps want to crusade against what's going on. And you are aware that Forbes magazine informed us that the single highest earning person in music was Valery Gergiev, yes, here. And wow. I'm not talking classical music. The single highest person in music. He made $16.5 million last year. He didn't get that just from conducting at the Mariinsky.
Wow.
Wait, but he made more than... Okay, we have to check what that figure means exactly, though, because, I mean, he made more than Justin Bieber. He made more than...
Justin Timberlake.
That's according to Forbes, you know. Mm. I mean, I haven't read the whole article, but you're right. Would need to be looked into, but even so, he knows where his bread is buttered, you know.
Just one correction here. Gergiev is the highest paid performer in Russia. It appeared in the Russian edition of Forbes, and it was reported in the English press incorrectly.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem to me like... I mean, look, Valery Gergiev's at the level, so is Anna Netrebko, that they could really say what they want
politically so.
And not have to worry about, what, they can't buy another castle? I mean, I just don't see it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering what would be the consequences of them actually saying something positive, you know, something in support of the gay community? I mean, would they go back to Russia and just be
jailed?
It would be loved by the West, and it would make Putin's ridiculous muscle man regime look even more ridiculous. It would be a big win if they were to say, you know, we're really sorry that we supported Putin because he's doing this stupid thing. And I think it would. It wouldn't be bad for them at all.
Even the Pope supports the gay community now.
Well,
to an extent, he said, at least says, who am I to judge? But so that's what I said to Peter Gelb's assistant who responded to me. I said, you know, well, a great deal of this would simply evaporate if we simply knew where Mr. Gary and Ms. Netrebko, if they simply made clear their position. All the air would go out of this. But all I'm saying is that were the Met to simply make a statement, it could be something as simple as a slip of inserted in each program. Tonight's performance is dedicated to this cause, you know. And it doesn't have to be a big ceremony, a big do. It doesn't have to recant or anything. It just would be making a positive declaration of something and then let those who don't that should have been done and say why, you know.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, I grew up in Texas, and I stayed originally with people there, a man by the name of Kent Cannon, who was very celebrated for having written one of the important orchestration books that everybody uses. And as a composer who himself used to be performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Eleanor Stieber sang some of his songs on tour and stuff. He's a minor figure, but he was a very fine man. But they forbid me back in the great dark ages. They were all trained at Eastman under Howard Hansen's regime. And so they were all very distressed when I became enamored of late Stravinsky, Alban Berg, and Schutter, Schoenberg.
Right. Hansen's music was very... I went to Eastman, and I think just because, as an undergrad, and just because Howard Hansen was such a name, I went and listened to a bunch of his music. I remember as a freshman, I listened to the Romantic Symphony, and it's all kind of neoclassical, and a lot of it's kind of nice, but it seems not friendly, wouldn't play well in the pool with Berg.
They were very unfriendly at Eastman to the second Viennese composers. And
so funny. Yeah. That's so funny.
To me as a kid.
It's not like that at all now. But yeah,
I know, it's so totally different now. I was at Eastman for some performances, and the kids were all into much more far out things. You know, and so it's all changed greatly. But oddly enough, when I was there at University of Texas, they forbid me to write 12-tone music, which was then regarded as an avant-garde phenomenon. Well, first of all, my teachers were so, stupid in this regard that I was writing 12-tone music and praising me for what I was doing, and it never occurred to me that they didn't see that that's what was going on. And one day, about 6 weeks into working on a piece with one of these teachers, he said, "Oh, well, don't you think F sharp would be the better here?" And I said, "Oh, I can't. that would not be the right note in the row." He said, "Oh, what row? Why are you putting rows into the piece at this point?" I said, "Well, the whole piece is 12-tone, I thought innocently, you know. And from that point on, I couldn't do anything right. Everything I did was wrong and terrible. And
So was he writing in some sort of kind of intuitive atonal style? Was it for him, it's just kind of wrong note tonality? Or
No. He was writing what I later said impudently to him. What should I do, write bad imitation Mio like you? It got really, 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 really bad. And fortunately, there was a very dear old man there, like so many people at University of Texas, drawing nice hefty salaries at the end of their lives, basking in a warm climate. And he had been a pupil of Arnold Schoenberg, and he knew Berg and Webern personally. And he, as a graduate faculty member, sort of paid attention to what some of us were up to, and he used to look at my pieces, and he just told me, there's nothing wrong with you, you're just in the wrong place, you need to go somewhere.
Is this Rockberg?
No, this man's name was Paul Pisk, P-I-S-K. He was a musicologist of some note, and I owe him greatly because he directed me. He said, well, I met a man at a convention, and he's taking over the music department at the University of Pennsylvania, and I think you should contact him. And I contacted George Rockberg. And I made my first trip to New York and went over to Philadelphia and took the train out to Bryn Mawr, where he was working at Theodore Presser. And I played him my orchestra piece, which was the bone of contention with this teacher. And he immediately opened every single door for me. He gave me a completely free ride through the University of Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And while there, I got to study with Ralph Shapey and Karlheinz Stockhausen and Hugo Weisgall. I became friends with Hugo Weisgall, and it was great, you know. And the whole trajectory of my life completely went in a different direction. I have to tell you, the most amazing thing happened to me this last January. I was at the McDowell Colony writing a new piece, and I was in a studio, and you know they have what they call tombstones, the little slabs of wood where everybody's been there, signs in their name. And so I'm looking through who's been in the studio. Who do I find there in 1954? Paul Pisk.
Wow.
What an omen. I thought, I have to write something really good here.
Yeah, McDowell just had their medal day, and they gave...
I was just there.
You were there, and my parents were there. That's my hometown.
Peterborough?
Yeah.
I love the place. I mean, it's just one of the dearest places on earth to me.
Oh, it's like Brigadoon.
Uh-huh. It almost is. All those old hippies and lefties.
Oh, it's funny. Well,
Stephen Sondheim got the medal this year, and I hear it was a madhouse.
It was amazing. There were 2,200 people showed up.
Oh, my gosh.
And it couldn't have been a more ideal. If you find my Facebook page, I have... little videos of Sondheim's acceptance speech.
And
Frank Rich's introductory remarks, and Michael Chabon, who started off the whole proceedings. I taped a couple of minutes of each of them and put them up on my Facebook page. So it was just great to be there. I just loved it. It was so. I've been to Medal Day 2 or 3 times, but this was absolutely the best one ever. And you'll love that. Frank Rich. Everybody was commenting on how just exceptionally ideal the weather was. The climate was. The temperature was great. The humidity, the breeze, everything. And Rich got up and said, "Yes, this is undoubtedly the most perfect day in history, except perhaps the one where Thornton Wilder wrote Act One of Our Town."
I have this theory about there. I feel like there are certain works that are just so good that after the person who wrote them or created them did finish them, they must have known. Like, you must have known Beethoven, when he finished the first movement of the Third Symphony, must have just had a moment where he knew, yeah, this is lightning here. I just have a feeling, yeah.
Opera Mission will present Creating the Work, Antonius and Hadrian. This three-part miniseries will offer a complete reading of a new opera with full orchestra. Composer Clint Borzoni and librettist Edward Ficklin will join conductor Jennifer Peterson in bringing the audience through the process of creating a new full-length opera. August 28th through September 7th. For more information, go to operamission.org.
There is nothing wrong with me, except too much time in this foul city.
I think that's right. I've had a couple of those moments with my own work where I thought, gee whiz, this is way better than I thought. The piece that really separated me from a student from a professional was a piece for Moog synthesizer, and I made a film to accompany it, and according to Moog, it was the first large-scale original serious piece made on his instruments, and once I got it all together and I sat back and looked at the finished product, I knew, oh my God, you know, I have really taken a giant step forward.
Is this Tragedia
coming out of all? No, Tragedia came about as a result of this piece. Nonesuch heard this piece, and originally they were going to record it along with several other composers. And then, because of Martin Subotnick's "Silver Apples of the Moon," they'd had this big success with that. So they asked Moog, "Well, who's done something on your machines?" And he said, he told them about me, and they gave me a whole LP to myself and said,
"Wow!"
So, what's the name of that piece?
This piece is called Il Giuoco.
It's an
antiquated word for game in Italian.
Right. Uh-huh. Right, the U makes it right because it's Gioco, but there's the U that makes it really old, right? Gioco.
It's Giuoco. That's a kind of antiquated spelling, but it's. If you look it up in the Italian dictionary, it says, what am I trying to say? Archaic for game. And I used to be, I learned about the Moog synthesizer from Alan Nicolai, who bought the first one. His sound technician saw it in an electronics show in New York and told him, "Nick, you should have this," you know. So he bought the prototype. And I had a friend who was in his dance company, and I would go every year to hand out programs and get to see the shows for free. And he said, "Are you going to be at the matinee tomorrow? Well, come back. I want to show you something." And so he showed me this thing, and I was still at the University of Pennsylvania, and they were setting up an electronic studio. So I told him about it, and Moog came down, and he brought a synthesizer in a car. cardboard box underneath a Greyhound bus.
Of course.
Of course he did.
Wow.
And then they set up right around the same time that Walter, now Wendy Carlos, was making Switched On Bach. He was building her system, and then he built an equally large system at University of Pennsylvania. And I, knowing absolutely nothing about any of it, just was, you know how you are if you're 26, you think you can do anything. So I just made this
piece. You can, yeah.
Yeah,
I can, and I did.
Yeah, wait. So I'm curious. Did you happen to catch the documentary they did there about Moog that they made? I'm not sure. 2009.
Yeah, they left me out. How could they do that?
Oh, why? What did you think of it? Well, you must have not thought highly if they let you out.
No, I liked it, and I knew many of the people that were being interviewed there, and so I was all for it, you know. But he was a great guy, and his whole thing was like, oh my God, I can't believe the piece you made. And my whole thing was, oh my God, your machines. And
so right. He wanted to
always watch guests on kind of thing, you know.
I was so surprised at how kind of mystical he was too.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, true. Somebody who's a tinkerer, and he has all this idea about the kind of spirit in the machine and the kind of it's just kind of crazy mysticism going on, which I didn't expect. Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Very early on, after I made that piece, but before I made Tragedia, he used to come himself. I mean, and service the machines and stuff, and bring us new gadgets and add-ons to our existing equipment. And so he told me one time, "Oh well, if you can come up to Trumansburg," he used to be in Lakes, you know, near Ithaca, in Trumansburg, New York, and he prepares yourself, and you can do adjustments without me having to come. And so I went up, and there were a bunch of little blue-haired ladies sitting there with soldering irons. That was before printed circuits, and they were literally just soldering together on pegboards. And I met Walter Carlos, who was yet to have done Switched On Bach, and it was like me, just someone trying to make electronic. You know, and none of us had any idea, including Moog, none of us had any idea that these things would become ubiquitous in rock bands, you know.
Yeah.
The whole birth of electronic music as a popular art form, as you know, just the sociology of it, the dance culture, dance music, internet. I mean, it's insane how generative Moog and all these people, Morton Subotnick, and I mean, it's just amazing what they were doing. And in the dark.
What was interesting to me was also that the people who most immediately glommed onto my stuff were people in the modern dance world, because they loved the idea that I could make them the piece and they didn't have to hire positions, and the tempo never varied and everything. And I would literally go and watch the dance. They could make the choreography, and I would watch the dance and make my timings, and then I would make the score to fit their choreography rather than them making the choreography to fit my music. And they loved that, you know.
Like a kind of return in some way. I mean, I don't think it was always. It seems like there's always a struggle when it comes to writing dance music between, is it about the motion or is it about the composition of the music? You know, and like that seems like a kind of reversal of practice right there. In a way,
there were some dancers who just simply could not imagine starting on the choreography without already having the music.
Right.
There were
others for whom it was totally liberating, and they loved the whole idea. And it's great, because I eventually became Nikolai's music assistant, and I did like four collaborations with him, and. But that was very exciting. I loved doing all that, and because it was very trendy in the 60s. Everybody wanted to be in on the sound of electronics and stuff. You know, now it's kind of passé, you know. But and I became much less interested in it after it all moved. I like the old analog synthesizers and all the stuff that happened in electronic music. Since it's become all computerized, I find it by and large less interesting, and I don't work with it at all anymore. So now I've become a reactionary, and I just do things like write operas and piano quartets.
Well, the funny thing, I'm a little bit familiar with the like electronic music now, and it seems to me that if you're somebody who understands programming and computer languages, that you can go really into the woods and you know, write all kind of music in all sorts of different ways that I kind of don't understand.
Yeah.
But just like Moog and people who developed synthesizers, there are people who are making things that are instruments. There are programs now that I would say that even though it is a music sequencer or a digital sequencer, it is itself, this program is an instrument of sorts, you know? And
of course.
Your average person, your average kid, like my students, I teach music up in the Bronx, my average students, not my average students, but some of my students will steal all of these programs off of the internet and learn how to use them in weeks and become like fluent at kind of making music at something.
That's the thing that I think is fabulous. But
wow.
What ultimately it comes down to is, at least to my, for me, no one gives a damn how you got the sounds.
Right.
if the sounds are really compelling. And what I was always after was to get away from that kind of, you know, little buggy, insecty, mechanical sound. I wanted sounds in electronic music that had the same kind of presence as, I don't know, core of trombones or something. I didn't want to be trombones, but I wanted to have that kind. And that's what those people who liked my music, that's what they liked about it, that the timbres were uniquely electronic, but I wasn't afraid to let them comparable to orchestral. In fact, the very first review of that first piece compared the sounds in my piece to Bruckner and Mahler. Because it had these big, it was very funny. There was a guy from Russia one time who came to Philadelphia, and they didn't have any electronic studio in Russia. And so he was touring around to see what they had. And a guy at our school took him to our electronic, and he played him that piece that I had written. As a demo, he couldn't believe there was this one sound. I mean, if I were to describe it, it would be kind of like if you had like 20 trombones and 12 French horns and the whistle on a steamship all sounded the same note at the same time. There was this huge brass blah kind of sound.
Yeah.
This guy would not believe that sound could have been made synthetically. He insisted that I had used real instruments and somehow altered them, and I couldn't prove it because I was so stupid in those days. I didn't have any idea. I just found them, and I didn't have any idea how to get them back again. You know, nowadays the computer could do that. You know, it could store the information and just regurgitate it for you. But so I made these sort of amazing sounds. But when I found something I liked, I composed with them. And that's what you're saying, like your kids are doing with these instruments, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, I run up against a lot of skepticism from people who talk, you know, like lay people who talk about electronic music or modern music, and they say, oh, you know, it's all computers, anybody can do it nowadays. And I really feel like it's like, the problem as an artist, as a composer, is having too many choices. And now we have more choices than ever, more decisions to make than ever. And that's a kind of nightmarish reality. It's not easy for a young person to make music nowadays. It's very difficult.
Well,
the anxiety of influence has never been greater, I think, you know.
And the other thing is, you know, like I fought the battle that they didn't want me to write atonal music. Now that would be a blessed camp to go to, because now with the whole polystylistic idea that, you know, people are just all over the map. Even in the same piece, you might have a section that was atonal and another section that almost sounded like 19th century harmonies, and another section that was Debussyan, and it might all somehow be united in the same piece, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's the politics of musical grammar that have completely changed. None of us know what's going on, you know, when it comes to tonality. What does tonality signify? Does it signify a relationship with, like, the left and with the avant-garde? Or no, of course not. You know, it's very difficult to know where the lines are drawn nowadays, I think, you know?
Also, you even have have acoustic groups like, you know, like Alarm Will Sound, who are actually playing electronic music on their acoustic instruments.
Yeah, they're fantastic. That group is fantastic.
Yeah. The most interesting thing was that, of course, I went to Texas to go and study with one of America's most foremost 12-tone composers, George Rochberg, who incidentally was a pupil of Luigi Dalla Piccola, who's the only composer that I wished I could have studied with. I did get to meet him once in Florence, and that was a thrill for me. But did you hear by any chance the concert performance of Il Prigioniero?
Recordings. I like that work a lot.
He's the 12-tone Puccini. I mean,
I know his music is so gentle and placid, and
But it can also be very impassioned, and it's very singable and very melodic. You know,
Dalla Piccola.
Most people think, he's great. You know, but.
People don't know. In college, I remember when I was in chorale, you know, Eastman Chorale, we did one early religious piece by George Rochberg, and it was like the first time I heard that kind of musical language as beautiful. Like, I knew it, I admired it, I admired that kind of music, but I never heard it. I never got that feeling that I got from tonal music until this moment where we sang this piece, and it was like, wow, if you tap into this way of hearing, it's a whole different language.
Do you remember
it's like
what
an
piece,
expression
what,
at a different level.
What piece was that? Do you know?
It was a setting of a religious text in Hebrew. So I think it might have just been called a hymn or something like that. Yeah. And what the deal was that it was, I remember all of the voices, it was a cappella, and within each measure, each voice part was completing a row. So if, like, you know, the tenor, we'd have three notes, that was 25% of the row, and each voice part accounted for each row. So every measure you heard the verticality of the row, and at the same time there was horizontal, like, you know, operations going on in the row. But it wouldn't matter if you understood the language of that at all, because it was just a really beautiful set of sounds. Like you were saying, Andrew, it's just beautiful to listen to. I mean,
I have to tell you a really funny, well, funny and also slightly painful for me, I went there to study with him for precisely that reason, and not because I really liked all of his music. Some pieces I liked, some pieces I didn't like, and some pieces I just didn't get. But I went to study with him because I saw immediately that he helped me write the music I wanted to write, and he could look at my music on my terms and help me make it better because he was more experienced. But about the time that I finished with my grad studies, Rochberg had a terrible tragedy in his life in which his 18-year-old son died of a brain tumor. And this kid was very, very bright, was beginning to have an already recognized career as a poet, and was a great, really proficient jazz saxophonist. And he and his father were very close. And that just undid Rochberg in a whole lot of ways. And he then abandoned writing 12-tone music. His third.
It gets really strange, right? Isn't that music for the magic theater and stuff?
That most peculiar piece. I never have understood that piece.
Oh, it's like one of the strangest. It's a question mark forever, I think. You know? Yeah.
His third string quartet combined. It just was all over the map stylistically, and it seems absurd now if you listen to it because so many other people are doing the same thing. But at the time, there were people who thought it was a great idea, and there were people who just thought it was absolutely, an abandonment of principles and all this kind of stuff. Well, at the height of this, I had a commission for, I think it was at the time of the American Bicentennial. They gave a series of recitals for young pianists, and I wrote pieces for pianist Lydia Artemu, and they were 12-tone pieces. And at that point, Rochberg and I had been sort of estranged for a number of years over, I won't go into all that, but anyway, I wanted him to hear these pieces, so I took Lydia out to his house, and she played the pieces for him, and, oh, he was just delighted with them and kept, oh, no, play that one. I have to hear that a second time and everything. So then his wife said, oh, well, let's go into lunch now. So we went in and we sat down, and he informed us that he also had one of the commissions in this series. And my pianist said, oh, well, what's your piece like? And he said, oh, well, it's a suite, and it has a blues, and it has it has a this and a that and the other, and it even has a 12-tone movement. And his wife nudges me, and she says, you were never afflicted with that particular disease, were you? And my pianist opened her eyes wide and said, perhaps unwisely, but these pieces are all 12-tone. And then it was like at the dinner table, like, who farted, you know?
I think it's so funny that people make that distinction. They suddenly, you know, if they hear a piece of music or a composer that they don't like that writes atonal music, then suddenly 12-tone and atonality is all chaotic and bad and scary, and all tonal music is just lovely, like it all sounds like, you know, Saint-Saëns or something. Like, it's like, that's not true. Like, there is a lot of really horrible and scary and sublime and not and discomforting tonal music, and there's a lot of really, it just, you know, it's just the idea that everything, that there's only one affect in one style.
Everything I've written since about 2004, it's all been 12-tone, but I don't tell anybody, you know?
And why should you?
I mean, why, you know...
No system ever made a piece of music good. You know, right. It's not this... Yeah. If that was all it took, then everybody could do it. You know, I get a great kick out of the fact that I don't tell people, and then I love when critics are struggling to try to describe my harmonic vocabulary, and I've had myself compared to Gershwin and all kind of stuff like that. And I wrote a piano concerto a couple of years ago, and the whole middle movement, people said, oh, it's obviously greatly indebted to Ravel. Well, of course it is, because I love Ravel. I deliberately just blatantly stole from his middle movement of his G major. But it's all done by 12-tone procedures. And I think a neat trick that I wrote the 12-tone piece that everybody thinks is Ravel, you know?
Yeah, that's very cool.
And I will have to say that I regard my viola concerto as probably it's my own opinion that it's the best work I ever did.
So then let's take a moment and listen to that.
You're on Spotify. I'm looking at your picture, very nice picture of you in front of a lake here.
That's my backyard.
Yeah, oh, beautiful.
Yeah, great. And my partner Tom took that picture. So,
oh, great. Nice.
Very nice.
I have to say, Andrew, that you're a fascinating guest. You're one of the best guests we've had on.
Oh, thanks a lot. I appreciate
that. Yeah, thank you.
I'm very talkative.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
I loved it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
And I'd like to close today's program with a little more of Andrew's music. This is from his Piano Concerto. Thank you for listening to the Indie Opera Podcast. You can listen by downloading directly from our website, on iTunes, on Spotify, or on Stitcher. Got Stitcher? We are on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.